Good evening and welcome to our Friday evening comparative study class. As all of you know, our schedule is posted in our periodical, and the meeting this Sunday will be a special one. It's a commemorative meeting, a celebration of the life and work of William Q. Judge. The meeting will be readings from various theosophical writings, an introduction on the life of William Q. Judge, and then a talk entitled Philosopher, Guide, and Friend. And anyone who has ever touched Judge's writings or been touched by his writings knows he is philosopher, guide, and friend. And that is Sunday morning. The doors open at 10:30. The meeting is from 11 to 12. But we do ask, since it is a devotional meeting, that people come in and be settled a little before the 11 o'clock hour, so we have a feeling of devotion. On this coming Wednesday night, as usual, we have our reference library, 5:30 to 7:30. And then from 7:45 to 9, our study class in Mr. Judge's Ocean of Theosophy. We're starting the chapter on Devakan. We have gotten through Kamaloka, and now we're entering into Devakan. The book table here in the lodge carries straight line theosophical literature and is sold at cost, the cost of printing and paper and the shipping to get it here to this building. So the prices are very, very reasonable. But if you don't want to own the books, you can always come in during library hours. The work that is done here or any lodge anywhere in the world is done on a voluntary basis. There are no collections, no dues, no fees, no officers, no organization. It is not an organization. It is an association of students. The other thing to be aware of is that in April, April 16th on a Saturday, we will have a forum entitled What You Don't Know About Karma. So it'll be that once in a while Saturday meeting from 1 to 3, and we'll have materials on it as it gets closer. Tonight we're talking about Patanjali's Yoga Aphorisms, this tiny book that we have for sale on the book table, a rendering done by Mr. Judge. Now, this title, Patanjali's Yoga Aphorisms, is known throughout the world. In the 11th century, it was translated into Arabic by a famous Muslim geographer, historian named Al-Biruni, and it's still in publication today. Here in America, the Transcendentalists, Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry David Thoreau, we can't say that they were practicing yoga, but if you read, after you've compared by reading Patanjali's, if you read their essays, their writings, you will see over and over the same echo of the same ideas. And we do know that both Emerson and Thoreau wrote about Hindu texts. Although they don't mention Patanjali, they did study the Bhagavad Gita and wrote about various Hindu ideas. So it is probably very likely that they were very familiar with these yoga sutras, which they are often called. Well, then you would think, I mean, considering we have centuries ago in the Arab world and in America a few hundred years ago, you would think Patanjali's would Patanjali would be well known. Well, you'd be wrong. It is a wonderful challenge to try to find information on the individual that actually created these aphorisms. First of all, it's very mysterious. Many deny that he ever even existed. They say, well, it was a bunch that got together and cobbled together all these differing ideas from other thinkers and created this thing and called it Patanjali's. The dates for his birth, where he is, believed, where he is believed to actually have lived, range over 1,000 years, from 500 before the Common Era to 400 in the Common Era. The credit that is given to him often then is that he invented yoga. Well, he didn't. So as you can see, everything that you will find out there is pretty much topsy-turvy. We're fortunate in that we have the Theosophical teachings. And in the glossary, we find that Patanjali's was born. I keep doing that. That's apostrophe S. His name is Patanjali. Patanjali was born nearer to 700 BCE than 600. So it's much, much older than we think. It is said that he's an adept who came to clarify the teachings that were already out there. And they were teachings that were current among the Hindus. Now, any student of theosophy knows why Patanjali could not be said to have invented yoga. Because we are students of the Bhagavad Gita, which was written over 5,000 years ago, and very early on in its presentation, it speaks of the two systems of thought, the Sankhya and the Yoga. Now, his life history, and this is understandable because like any adept, like any spiritual teacher, his life history is wrapped up in myths and legends. When he is depicted, he is shown with the head of a cobra over him. He has four arms, two in the position of namaste, of the greeting of the spirit, one holding a conch shell and one holding the wheel of evolution. His name translates as the grace that fell from heaven. So in his day, he was recognized as a spiritual teacher who came to offer assistance to souls. Of course, as all of these spiritual teachers, he had no ordinary childhood. He was able to lecture almost from birth. And his metaphysical and philosophical awareness staggered everyone. He is often called the father of yoga, but he should be called the father of Raja Yoga, of the kingly science, the science of the development of the mind, of the soul in control of its instruments. For the word yoga means to yoke, to join, to unite. And it's funny, it's one of those strange words where it is the description of what you do and the doing of it. It is said you perform yoga, and yet yoga is a thing itself, a study. In that search for freedom for the soul, Raja Yoga is practical and leads to the highest summits of spiritual growth. The aphorisms contain 195 sutras. It doesn't sound like a lot, but as you will hear, they are amazing and profound. We've always thought there were about 10,000 in here. Sutra, the word, the Sanskrit word sutra, means thread, a thread of thought which can be condensed. And that's the benefit. He gave a framework for the teachings that focused on practice, not theory, on condensing the ideas so you weren't dealing with a lot of words and adjectives. You were dealing with the pure thought. His core of teaching deals with an eight-limbed path of Raja Yoga, which we will hear about. It involves mind control, meditation, and self-study. Whereas Hatha Yoga, which most people think of when they hear the word yoga, is breath control and physical postures, and wasn't even created until around 1200 BC, CE. Even though we can't know much about Patanjali, and you can't find much, you can know his heart, his mind, and his devotion by studying these amazing aphorisms. And we will now hear something about them.
Well, as said, there's 195, and they're very terse, compact, and potent. So it's misleading. It's very misleading because it's not flowery. It's very direct, and it's like, you know, it's based on action. The only way to achieve yoga or union is through action. There's very little, actually, that relates to the Hatha Yoga practices, and that's more or less, we just want to put a disclaimer out there, it's more or less as an adjunct to all the other practices, and it's basically addressed to the mind and the body of Asians or Indian Aryans, because for Westerners to do it with or without a teacher can result in grievous physical breakdown or death. So it is not recommended at this time in the East, or in the West rather. That may change as time goes on, but currently that's the way it is. So Patanjali's system of Raja Yoga, the goal is to control the mind itself by following the rules laid down by the greatest of adepts. Patanjali's rules compel the student to acquire a right knowledge of what is and what is not real. Now, this is accomplished while practicing all of the virtues. This is the slow, sure, tried, and true method of psychic development, as opposed to the aforementioned Hatha Yoga, which it is infinitely safer and certainly more spiritual than Hatha Yoga, which accomplishes psychic development at the delay or expense of the spiritual nature. Also, any gains made in Hatha Yoga, anything, it's all lost at the end of this particular incarnation. It's gone. Now, reincarnation was assumed to be a fact in India, and it still is. So Patanjali only indirectly, there are references which one would have to assume that reincarnation is a fact. One aphorism has to do with the recalling all the past lives and all of the knowledge gained in those past lives and being able to use them during this life. So he states that the ascetic can know what were his previous incarnations and all of their circumstances. So in order to understand the system expounded, it is necessary to admit the existence of soul, with the physical body being relatively unimportant. Nature exists for the sake of soul. Therefore, he offers no proof, it being the common legacy of the people. So the mind is the instrument of soul, and the mind is designated as an internal organ. It talks about snatching and holding the mind, and which is the main, really the main organ of sense. It's generally not thought of as an organ of sense, but it is, because it controls all of the senses. So the mind is modified by any object or subject which is brought before it or to which it is directed. In that, it is like water. It readily adapts itself to any mold that it enters. So once the internal organ of mind is so molded, at the same time it reflects it and the properties to the soul. And then it channels it back to the senses. It immediately reflects it back through touch, sight, taste, smell, hearing. And we are also modified by speech and hearing, and by association and recollection. So these are all examples of hindrances which we first have to be able to concentrate, and we have to attain calmness before we can have any progress on Patanjali's path. So we need to access a superior power of mind in order to grasp and hold it. Otherwise, we'll be buffeted by the whims and fantasies of the world. The superior power is soul, and it is also our constant power. Now, this sovereignty has been usurped. The sovereignty of the soul has been usurped by the lower passions and desires. So we have to raise the self by the self. We have to raise the lower self by the higher self. And this is the constant struggle, which is we study nearly every summer. Sometimes we don't, but nearly every summer we study the Bhagavad Gita, and it's also called the study of adepts. It's a good study to do year round, a good self-study to do year round on your own. It is that constant struggle of the higher and the lower. And we wanted to mention the four books. The aphorisms, the 195 aphorisms are broken into four books. Book one is Concentration. Book two is titled Means of Concentration. Book four, The Essential Nature of Isolation. And we skipped over three because it is mysteriously not named. However, it is for the purpose of defining the nature of the perfected state. And this state is isolation, which is covered in book four. So book three would be a prelude to isolation. Now, we're not talking about isolation from our fellows, because although there are sages and hermits that do isolate out in the wilds, it has to do with isolating the mind. And So it's the also it's the isolation of the soul. We should bear in mind that isolation of the soul in this philosophy does not mean that a man is isolated from his fellows. So it is isolating that the soul, excuse me, because the mind is an instrument of the soul. And so it's using the soul to raise the self by the self. So the bondage of matter, from the bondage of matter and desire. And this is the very means to accomplish the aim of nature and soul, including the souls of all men. Now, we do have, if any questions come up about specific aphorisms, we don't have time really to go into them right now, but we will open it up for discussion at this point.
We just wanted to say, if you don't own the book, you can go onto the Phoenix website, if you have a computer, and it's all there, the entire book. So you can stop at the book table and get the instructions for the website. Yes.
Going back to the very beginning, knowing how important symbols are, it was said in the second half of the talk about how important sound and speech are. And we were struck by the fact that in the picture of him, he's holding a conch shell and the wheel. And we were thinking not only inside the conch, if you could see, there's a spiral, but often that sound was used to gather people for sacred rituals and the like.
That is why he's holding the conch shell. It's the instrument to call the souls together. And that was his point and purpose. It's interesting that we just had St. Patrick's Day, because when you see the statuary, he has the cobra head behind him and his lower body is made up of a snake coil. And that is recognized as the sign of a high adept. Jesus said it, "Be ye wise as serpents." And it's interesting that we just had St. Patrick's Day, and the world rather goes mad celebrating it because they don't know what it means. When the snakes were driven from Ireland, it means when the materialistic or controlling or dogmatic ideas took hold, the adepts had to leave Ireland. So St. Patrick's Day represents a tragedy. It's a description of a myth, again, but it is a tragedy for wisdom. Yes?
It was mentioned about
Well, they're in here somewhere.
Well, I have a printout on his eight-limbed path, which is the second book, and it is Raja Yoga. And he has five things to abstain from: violence, inflicting any injury, even violence to oneself in thought, word, or deed. Lying,
right?
Not or coveting,
not stealing,
non-possessiveness, clean thoughts, and five things to do: the cleanliness of body and mind, satisfaction with what you have and what you are at the moment, austerity and observances for body discipline, study of the scriptures to know about God and the soul, which awakens the soul. Surrender to the higher deity. And then it continues with postures to preserve vital energy, not to do the hatha yoga exercises, but a harmonizing of the body and mind to fit you for meditation. Control of breath helps the concentration of the mind. withdrawal of the mind from the senses, concentration, steady meditation, and then samadhi, which is entering into that higher state.
So often we hear that, you know, we human beings who so often perceive ourselves or describe ourselves as this body, this physical body, Yasati often brings up that we in fact are mind beings. That's what the human being is, a mind being. Patanjali brings up the idea that we are to control the mind and control maybe the conditions around the mind or something like this. And if in fact we're able to do that, then we must be more than what our mind is. And if that's the case, then are we mind beings or are we more than that, or how do we fit that?
There's a wonderful statement in the philosophy that mind represents three things. It is a principle in the universe. It is an incarnation in the sense that it is a mind being, but it is also universal. So the mind in the individual is an instrument. But as their nature, their manifesting nature, the soul is threefold. It is Atma, Buddhi, mind. There's a thinker there. A thinker is not the mind. A thinker is the whole package, we might say, of spirit or force, intuition or past use of the mind, and then the mind as an instrument of use. So we are mind beings, but that's not all we are.
Go ahead. Can I follow up with that?
Sure.
And that being the case, we are mind beings, that's not all we are, we're more than that. When we hear that phrase, raising of the self by the self, one of those selves has a capital S, one has a small s, which self is doing the raising? Which self is doing the work? Is the higher self doing the work, or is the lower self?
That's a very good question. Well, the lower self has to do the work, but we are never without a friend and companion. We have access to that storehouse of wisdom, which is soul. It's the accumulated wisdom of the ages. It's that Buddhi principle, that higher principle. So raising the self by the self, well, we don't think we can really raise the higher self, can we? I mean, it's so.
So does the higher self work to raise the lower self, or
The lower self works to raise itself by the help.
Well, it's so confusing. It's as confusing as this book.
And then there's the self of all.
Right.
So there's a third self.
That is the higher self, the self of all. It's
right.
No different in any being. Even the wood of this table is composed of that. And then there is the self in incarnation, which is the thinker at work in a form. The minute the thinker joins with a form, you have a higher mind and a lower mind. It's just one mind. It's which way that mind is being used. It's like a scale. The center of the scale is the soul. Either side is the higher or lower use of that. The lower cannot raise itself. It's not possible. It is only the soul within turning to the higher, leaving the lower, what's the word, in its normal position, which is the instrument of the mind. The mind is the instrument of the soul. The lower nature is the instrument of the mind. So you can't really say, when you say raising the self by the self, you're saying, I as a thinker am lifting up my use of mind and instruments. But it's really, in reality, just one thing.
And behind will stands desire. We need to have that desire first. And it's very interesting, though, because there are some very willful people that accomplish marvelous things on the physical plane, but their will is behind their will is desire too, but it's a desire for things of the material plane, and actually they're being held prisoner by that. So behind will stands desire. So we have to watch our motive and our desires. If we truly desire this knowledge, if we want to be workers for humanity, then we have to always watch our motives and make sure our desires are as pure as we can make them. And we need to attain to concentration. We need to attain to calm. We need to attain calmness, equanimity, just that. And then the light will shine through from the higher. That soul wisdom, it will shine through. And then we have great powers. We're told that we're very powerful beings, but we've lost our way through the
use of will and desire.
through will and desire, misuse of, or through experimenting, through knowledge, through playing too much and getting lost in it.
Yes.
And we just read recently in the philosophy, we can't remember where it is, about how the higher nature won't come down, won't ever come down to us, that we have to elevate ourselves up to them.
Well, you know, another way of saying that is, why should something that is always there, like the sun giving light and life to the earth, why should it come down to you? It's already there. You move towards it. You know, you were saying about the motive and helping humanity. We couldn't help but notice the older couples, the older Japanese couples that have been interviewed. They're mostly Buddhists, so they have a very different attitude about life and responsibility. And this one older couple had come back into their property and were trying to rescue whatever they could, and they were being interviewed. And the man smiled and said, "We're in a hurry. We have to find what we can so we can go and help everybody else." It's quite a different attitude. Yes?
One of the ways we can prove to ourselves that there isn't two selves, the higher and the lower.
Well, wait, don't say it that way. There's two aspects of one self.
Exactly.
Yes.
But to raise the self by the self means, preliminarily, to focus the mind on the higher.
Mm-hmm.
It's already there. It's not something we need to bring in. It's already within us. It's us turning from one to the other, so they can't be separate. They're the same.
They're never separate.
Right.
The problem is, it's the way we focus. You turn this way, you are focused in the lower. You know, Mr. Judge refers to it as you have closed doors through your thinking, your acting, your willing, your desires, and you've locked them behind you, and now you want them. Well, as you said, you have to focus on the higher to find the key within your own nature, something that you're not doing as a soul. And when you find that, then you are free to move on. Yep.
Try to concentrate, our mind flies in all directions. Are there any directions given on how we should begin this to keep the mind from flying all over the place?
Well, other than the directions that are given in Hatha Yoga, which we're directed not to pay attention to too much, well, there's meditation with a seed. and meditation without a seed. They're the two levels of meditation. So beginners need to have a seed in order to meditate. Some higher thought, it could be of the masters of wisdom, it could be on Om, it could be on any higher altruistic thought, really. Whatever works to center the mind. Even more rudimentary than that, there's something called muttering. It's just kind of like saying a phrase to yourself. So there are examples.
But he mentioned specifically concentration, which really comes as the precursor to what you're talking about, to meditation. Mr. Crosby gives some wonderful examples. First, find out what are your concentration capacities. Tell yourself you're going to focus on one idea, whatever it is. It can be a mundane idea. It doesn't matter. Pick an idea, look at the clock, and start to think about it. The minute your mind goes elsewhere, look at the clock and go, "Ooh, not even 2 minutes." Try it again. Try it again. Begin to see the condition you have created for yourself. Then think of yourself doing something that you really love. Now, maybe as a child, you loved to be outside at night playing hide-and-go-seek or riding bikes or whatever, and you didn't even pay any attention to what time it was, how dark it was. You didn't even hear your parents calling you. You were so focused on the joy of what you were doing. Everybody can think of examples. What's the difference between trying to concentrate and concentrating so naturally, the way we did as a child, or we might do at work, or playing a musical instrument, or reading a book? The difference is we want to do the one. We take joy in it. The other is like a punishment or like going to the dentist. What we have to realize is we have the skill. It's the attitude that's a problem. So in order to develop it better, you say, okay, as soon as my mind says, we're going to think about this thing we have to do next week or the dentist appointment we have to make, whatever it is, immediately you stop and you say, all right, I hear that. I will think about that later. I'm thinking about this. And you keep bringing the mind back and back. It's a muscle you're developing. You will develop concentration. When you get your concentration developed enough, then you can do the beginning steps of meditation, because your mind can hold a focus. It can. Everyone can. It's just we've forgotten how to do it. We're very carefree, and we memorize things instead of working at them. Yes?
So then when we do work on our concentration, we're concentrating what different forces of our mind. What are some of those forces or the tools of the mind that we bring together?
Well, it's said that the mind is thought, will, feeling, memory, and imagination. That those are the powers contained within us, and they're all spiritual. We don't know if you've ever read Epictetus, but he will make you laugh out loud when he says, you know, if you were to describe the powers of a god, what would it be? Well, the ability to imagine and create and think and to will things into existence. Now realize you have all those powers. It's just you use them against yourself instead of for yourself. So we already are using all the forces of the mind.
And I just want to interject here. The obstructions are ignorance, egotism, attachment, aversion, and clinging to life.
Well, I have all of those.
Yeah. So if thought, will, feeling, memory, and imagination are the
powers of the mind
that we're to concentrate when we meditate, what should we should we feel? What should we remember? And what should we imagine?
Well, that's very hard to say because it's individual. One person could turn on some beautiful music and just sit for a while and have cleared or sort of cleansed their mind for the moment so that they can concentrate. Another might need to read some poetry or to read from Patanjali or the Bhagavad Gita. It's individual because we all have the same powers, but no two of us are standing in the same place. It is said that's why in the Hindu tradition, when they show a picture or a sculpture of a soul, eyes and ears in every direction, arms and legs in every direction, because we are all unique and yet we're exactly the same. So it's impossible to answer your question. Yes?
One of the things that I ran across with that, as a prerequisite before meditation, after you have concentration, after you've tamed the monkey mind and settled it down, before you sit down and meditate, the first thing you do is to cleanse your mind of all of the negative thoughts and feelings that you have acquired during that day. It's like washing your body.
Mm-hmm.
You cleanse your mind, then you sit down and you meditate upon whatever it is that you find uplifting.
Yes.
Is that
why they call many of the theosophical books devotional books? There must be a connection. Why did they call them devotional books?
And what are we devoted to?
We're devoted to that, the self of all, that the spirit, Ishvara.
But what are we devoted to?
We're devoted
making
to
making money, making friends.
Well, that's true.
Becoming popular, rich, famous.
Right.
Our devotion is all that way. And the devotional books remind us that the real meaning
right.
is inward.
The devotional books are there to help us clean up a lot of the mental deposits, the skandhas that are attracted back to us in life after life after life that we have built up. They're those elemental lives that are everywhere and that are
servants.
They're servants. We can direct them, but unfortunately, if we let ourselves go, then they direct us in a way. We just go every which way. And that's why we're warned against passivity, we're warned against drunkenness and gluttony, anything that will make us passive, because these mental deposits are very very hard to clean up. But we need to wed the manas with buddhi. That's the creative power. That's where the creativity comes in.
Yes.
Might we think of devotional as sacred? Because it's separate from a regular book or a regular teaching, a high school book or a mathematical principle. It's a separate kind of thought put into print for us that awakens the mind, awakens the soul, energizes the heart. So it's a perhaps devotional is a reminder that we seek out the sacred and the mundane. Mm-hmm. And therefore lift or raise.
But you know what's funny about that? I mean, that's beautifully put. But anything that we're going to study, whether it's chemistry or mathematics, is exactly as you have just described, a devotional book. It's a set of principles or ideas that we're to take in the mind and then actively use.
Right.
The problem is that we do that with the math book, if we're lucky, and the chemistry book and the history book. We don't do it with the devotional book. We have the devotional book and it's about them. Those souls who are much better, who are wise, who are gentle. It's not about people like me. And yet HPV says over and over that all of these books are written for us, the sinners, the fools, the idiots, because we've lost our way, and the ones who've written them are the ones who have been where we are now.
And don't we need to devote ourselves to this study? That's the other term for devotional. It takes devotion. It takes effort. As with any study, but as was said earlier, this is something that is overlooked by many. But
fear.
And yeah.
Yes. We have been taught, even in school, what are we taught? Are we taught to think about a subject? Or are we taught to memorize what the book tells us about a subject? We're not talking about math, because that you have to use and do. But in most of the things, we're taught, how well can you echo back what you've been fed? And you get a better grade if you're able to repeat it accurately. Well, that is not thinking, and that is not learning. And if we take that to religion and devotion, we don't get anywhere. We're just mimicking.
Well, especially with religion, traditional religions, you're taught to, this is the way it is. It's dogmatic. It's orthodox or whatever. But the opposite is what we always strive to do at the United Lodge of Theosophists, and that is to use the Socratic method to constantly question everything. And that will break up the mental deposits, and that will get one thinking on a completely different plane. And it may be years later. These classes go on year-round, and it's generally the ocean for 9 months and the Gita for 3. But it's amazing that year after year, new questions are asked that were never asked before, or they're asked a little different way, a little different angle. All these things, they break up these mental deposits, and they help to get one thinking and concentrating better.
And just like the classes go on and on, we go on and on. We may struggle to understand the yoga aphorisms, apply them as we can, and not get that far as we can tell. But we return with that energy, that impulse. The effort we have put in becomes the foundation for learning more. So we can never give up, even on ourselves.
And one more thing about the mental deposits are also regarded as astral images. So they're a form of astral matter. And it needs to be, it accompanies us when we come back, when we reincarnate. So we need to purify that. The astral around the earth is far too polluted, and it needs to be be purified.
And then taking that into what we just studied in the ocean, the lower cannot reincarnate. It's not possible. It was a temporary condition of the thinker. What does reincarnate are all of the astral matter that was not elevated. So we bring back with us all of those negative tendencies, but we also bring back with us the sort of spiritual uplift that we get from that heaven state dream. So that's all that remains of this thing right now that we think we have to worry about, take care of, care about more than anything else. It's a temporary vehicle we're driving, and that's all. Yes.
One of the aphorisms has to do with the mind typically, or has this tendency to take the form of that upon which it dwells.
It's the water example he gave.
Mm-hmm. And that's to be corrected. You don't want the mind to do that.
No.
Well, it depends. It takes any form. You want it to take a good form. You just don't want it to take a form that's
Well, that's dependent on you. What are you thinking about? In other words, if you picture a pitcher, a big, fat, round, happy pitcher, when you pour the water into that pitcher, the water is now that shape. It has no choice. What he's saying is your mind takes the shape of what you pour it into. So if you're looking at degrading things or disgusting things or cruel things, your mind takes that shape. If you want to elevate your thinking, you look at things that are higher, that are beautiful, that are natural, that reflect universal ideas, because that's the shape your mind is going to take. It's a huge idea.
And if we want to put it into a better shape, we study philosophy and we prepare the way for its release.
Freedom, yes.
There are two comments and movie lines in the movie Gladiator, which I grew fond of. The one typically heard with especially the male viewers is strength and honor, which I'm not so impressed with.
Oh, but, really?
And he also says at one point, which something I'm very impressed with, how you live now echoes in eternity. Mm-hmm. So my question is there a truth to that? I'm hoping there is, because I'm getting very impressed over a few words here.
A, of course there is. But B, nothing takes away the vitality of the thinker. Everything that you think and will and feel is real and is lasting because it becomes part of you. But you may have willed and thought pretty terrible things. You can alter that. You can clean up the past and do better in the future. And that's the other aphorisms. That's the karmic aphorisms.
That would be an echo you would want to hear.
Once a year?
Want to hear.
Oh.
Well, we just want to say something about strength and honor because we think it's very important. It may sound like a cliche depending on the context that it's in. But in the Eastern schools, perfect physical health is a requirement to be a chela of a guru. And that is not the case. Our bodies are so diseased here in the West. Fortunately, there's an exception made to that rule. But honor, you absolutely have to honor any dishonor to either parent or a wife, or really anyone, but especially a parent or a spouse, is considered, you know, there's no way someone will be would be able to advance on the path if they show disrespect. So strength and honor are important, and as we clean up our mental deposits, as we improve our concentration, as we can let this grand heritage, which was ours and will be ours in the future, if we raise the self by the self, then we will be able to move on.
And this is definitely not for weaklings. It is said the only tuition that you have to pay for spiritual wisdom is your very self. So it takes all of your strength, yes.
Now, I guess why it meant so little to me is you hear the term consider the source if I'm, you know, witnessing or seeing the image of an invading army into other nations is nothing more than organized crime. And to hear them bellow out strength and honor hasn't got much appeal to me.
Well, you know, that's such a difficult question because an advancing army can also be moving in to protect the innocent. So, you know, we cannot snap to judgment. What we can realize is that what we're seeing often is the acting out of huge karmic events from the past. And we don't know the sources. We can only hope that everyone will act in an honorable way. And we have made a science out of the opposite. I remember when I was a child hearing for the first time that, oh, it isn't that the crime is wrong, it's getting caught committing the crime is wrong. We've put a spin on everything so we can get away with what we want. Why? Because we have forgotten that we never die and that we will reap the results no matter what we got away with. We didn't get away with anything. So we've messed up things for ourselves by creating lies that we live by. You had your hand up before.
Well, we heard the term independent devotion. And in most cases in our society, we rely on the preacher or the priest or someone like that. Independent devotion. We don't depend on anyone else, but we still have to have a basis. And we understand that the declaration was mentioned there. Why is that so very important for independent devotion?
Well, the fact that we can gather together freely and discuss these ideas, share them with each other. We are each independently devoted, but we're devoted to the good of all of the others who are hungry for these truths. And we just have time for one more.
So taking the last two ideas, we see the advancing troops, and it may be that most of them are fulfilling a duty. And we're called to that position either by, in Arjuna's case, birth, born into that tribe, or whatever the karmic circumstances are, as was said. So all we can do is send our very best hopes and thoughts and will, prayer, if you want to call it that, towards everyone involved.
But there is more, much more that we can do. War on the outside represents the war I won't fight in me. So if I don't want war and pain and suffering in the world, it's me I have to fix. So there is harmlessness in me, and that will permeate outward.
Yes, it's interesting to study cycles. And we can see patterns. We can see things coming back, that the return of things that once were. And there have been wars for... this is Kali Yuga, and things are very topsy-turvy. It's a dark age, and it's black with horrors. But it's a cycle. We need to learn from it. We can learn more in this cycle than any other cycle. And it's very easy to... Well, it's very easy to judge the motives of others, but we really don't know what they're operating under. Whatever comes to us comes under law, and it's said that, you know, we were at some time connected with this, otherwise we wouldn't be here. So whatever crazy karma that's going on in the world, we were connected with it. Now, we just wanted to... We wanted to mention that the book ends with the saying, little postscript that says, may Ishwara, which is the higher self, the self of all, may Ishwara be near and help those who read this book, Om. And to this I would like to append, the enemies which rise within the body, hard to overcome, the evil passions should bravely be fought. Who conquers these is equal to the conqueror of worlds.
And it may be the Black Iron Age, but we have these books, don't we?
We do.
We didn't in other ages. Yes. Meeting is adjourned. That's nice.
Thanks.
It's so funny, I found this. Five things to abstain from. Abstain from nonviolence? Huh? Okay. You're very different.
Yeah, I think that might have been wrong.
You too.
I want to study this more, though. That's it.
Pardon?
I don't know if Mary will talk to us.
Oh, we'll give her one of those slips.
She can't read. You have to tell her.
I couldn't smell it.
She's legally blind.
Hmm?
She's legally blind.
Oh, tell her about it.
Somebody
wow.
Get this out of the way, make it easier.
Well, you know what? We don't need it. It can go to the library.
Okay, I'll do that.
Because
thanks for coming, Charles.